Mr. Carter, reel 18. We were talking about the clothing that you sent back and was received, but your parents didn't think it was you at the end of the day, that you were all right.
Yeah. And the other lad was with me. Well, there were very few that had been with us now, but he was one of them. And he kept close to me. They called him Dave Cherry. He was a Cornish lad, a big tall Cornish lad. And he said to me, he had this material to make his wife some clothes, you see. So he bundled one up and we took it to the company office to send them away. Now, the next day, we'd been sent forward. And we were trying to dig in, and there were Germans in front, and one of the lads said, "The Germans coming." Well, we weren't in a position to give up. We couldn't dig in, it was hard, we'd only got partly dug in. Our policy then was not to return fire. Of course, they used the usual open up fire on us. We didn't reply, and they left. But before they left, I got the peat gun, which wouldn't give a flash or anything. I got the peat gun and I loaded it to send this peat shell back, see, because they wouldn't know where it come from, because there's no flash with that. And down there, the bomb just trickled out of the muzzle and dropped in front of me. So that was that. Anyway, our artillery opened up, and God, the earth shook in front of us, absolutely shook. It shook like that. So I said, "We've had enough of this." I brought them out, took them back to the company. And the company commander, I didn't like him at all. He said, "You never fired on them Germans, did you?" I said, "No, we weren't doing." And of course, we had our top coats, we'd left them, you see. And it was night time, and we wanted our top coats. And I said, "Well, we'll have to go back for our top coats, lads." And they weren't too keen on going, so I said, I was that disgusted, and I said, "Well, I'm going back for my top coat." And I strode across the open field. I didn't care a damn, I was that mad with them, for what I'd done for them. And suddenly, a bunch of them, with this, another sergeant, went round the edge, covered me. Now it's straight in the open ground. We got our top coats and went back. And then it came out that we'd been over the bombing line again. And he placed me in this position again, obviously.
Was this a change of company commander from Lofthouse?
Lofthouse went somewhere else. And this one was...
Remember his name?
I couldn't remember his name, no. But
he
did that a few times, put me out in the front. Because I had no officer, you see.
You must have, by now, be finding out the men that you could rely on and those who were a bit windy. Does this happen in every unit, that you do have a number who you can trust and rely on?
Well,
and others?
You more or less stick to your old ones, like they stick to you as well, because we were sent out to find the enemy. They knew that where the enemy was, and we were sent out one night to find them if they were still there. Now this A company was to come in after we'd found them, that there were to be the fighting patrol. We were to find them and tell them where they were. So we went, we got near to them, and they must have heard us. They slung a grenade over, and one of the sergeants got wounded. So we'd done our job, we knew they were there, so we retreated. And then the Spanders opened up. They were on fixed lines, and bullets were flying over the top of them, as you see. So I fell down, because they were close enough going over the top. And there were no lads that were in front of me there, were running. They turned round and said, so I dropped. And they came back to me and they said, are you wounded? I said, no. So that's how close you get with your old mate. Others wouldn't have done that, come back to you and let them kill you off, but they came back to me. One was Dave Cherry. And of course, then we had to find a company to tell them it was okay. And we waited. And we saw this open order of troops coming across this field. We didn't know whether they were Germans or an A company. So we were ready to fire on them. And when we got near, we saw they were A company. So I went up to these officers and I said, the Germans are still there in that position. I said, I'll take you back to where they are. Oh, he said, it'll be all right. We'll find them. Yes, no intention of them. Which, in my estimation, when I look back, he did right. Because, what chance of you going again, was it? I mean, you have all the firepower you want, mortars, machine guns, and that. Blast them. Not send troops in armed with that's the old fashioned First World War. You're just sending men to the death to attack them, was it? When you hadn't, even if you'd had mortars with them, would have been better, but they hadn't even mortars with them. So, though I blessed him in a way, afterwards I thought, well, you did right. And I found out from one of the lads that was correct. But he'd said, and we'll just patrol up and down here and then we'll go back. Mm-hmm. Which was good. But what I hated about it was when we were at the conference, he was going to go in with A company, he was going to blast him and listen to him, he was telling him off to some business. Oh, but he did all right to me after when I could defend. You can't attack a position like that when you have plenty of good support, such as mortars and machine guns, going with them. Germans would never do that. They're going with full support.
Which unit was the machine gun support to you?
Cheshire's. Funny thing, they used to what they call harassing fire. And you hear them at night time. You see, at night time, both Germans and those would be feeding. And this was classed as harassing fire. Catch them on out of the trenches going for the drum.
You wouldn't be able to move during the day very much, would you?
No, I didn't move much during the day. No.
Were you getting tired by this time? How many days or weeks are we into the since you landed?
Well, we got into August, I think. I'll tell you about this dear Cherry. We again were pushed forward. We got to this incident, what I just recalled. And we're digging in again. My God, it was hard going. We couldn't dig. It was on the hill. And dear Cherry was over 6 foot. Now this tank which I told him about, what was in this wood, he came out and he opened fire. And of course, he spotted this newly soil and he started on us. Well, there was just room for me to get to the bottom of this slip trench we'd dug. We've been small. I got to the bottom and Dave Cherry got on top of me. But one of his legs was stuck up above the parapet, you see. And all of a sudden, he said, I've been hit. And he made an attempt to get out. And I said, no, I held him back for him. Till they dealt with tank. And they did deal with tank. Settled him. And that was the last I saw of Dave Cherry. He was hopping on one leg back to first aid. I never saw him no more. He said before he... before he went, like he said, see that parcel gets to my wife. I said yes. But that was a body blow because we were losing the girl. There wasn't anybody left, more or less, you know, all the young ones, you know. But there was a mistake made in reinforcements. There were two old fellas, and we were in battle, and we'd been bombarded. And they were shaking like leaves. And if I told, I told them to dig, by God, did they dig? Oh, God, aye. Anyway, it got worse and worse. And one day after a bombardment, we went round to see that everything was all right. Me and the officer, we had an officer that day. And we looked down at these two, and they were shaking away, you know. That said to me, we shouldn't be here, we're graded men, we're graded. I said, well, I can't do nothing about it now till we go out. And but we had to stick it till he went out for the rest. But it got so bad for him when we looked down, I said to the officer, I just went, no. So I said, come out, you two. I said, you're going back to the first aid post. I said, you don't need your spade. He said, he wouldn't part with his spade. Oh, don't do it, he wouldn't part with his spade. He said, we're two good diggers, aren't we, Sergeant? I said, I said, yes, you're my best two diggers I've ever had. But I couldn't go there, do you?
And they would
have been miners. Anyway, there were some wounded sent back. One of the lads went back with a wounded, and he came back. He said, you know that old fella that wouldn't let go of his head? He said, he's still laid there, and he's still clung to his head like. And the other one wasn't so bad, because when we pulled out, they kept him on at the Yesland, you know, quartermasters, and he helped with the cookhouse. And he would remain there all the time with them. But all that was gone. Oh dear.
Could you sympathise with men that cracked up like that?
Well, I could, yes, because he was in a terrible state. And I mean, as he said, he was an oldest fellow, and he said he was greedy. They'd made a mistake in something they loved. He should have been with pioneers or something like that.
Did you have any men who cracked under the strain and either wouldn't go forward or ran back?
Yes, we had two deserters.
Do you recall how that came about?
Yes, we were advancing, and they were with me, and they decided they were going to go forward. And,
you would order them forward, did you?
Well, they were supposed to go forward with me, but they wouldn't go forward, and just turned and went back. They were picked up with the Red Caps, and they went in front of Loftus. And of course, they were caught answered, and they got 5 years. But I did hear one of them, when they were short of infantry, I think they went round the glass house offering them, if they went back in the line, they'd wash the slate clear. I think this one did do it. Went back.
One of them came out.
And his slate was washed clear.
What's the general response of men who risk their lives day in, day out to other men who break like this?
Well, we never had any.
But deserters like this, was there a danger that they could affect the morale of a unit deserting in the face of the enemy? Or
no, it was, it was not like the First World War, where you're stuck in the trenches and somebody went absent. We were always on the move and that, always fresh faces and that. So it was soon forgot.
Where were your drafts coming from?
Well, as I told you, Skegness, where I was with this Sergeant Beatty, we had a bit of trouble with him. Nowadays, there's a little company there. Oh, this is amazing. This is a company. And there'd been some reinforcements, and I was walking around the field, and I heard this voice in the corner. And I said to myself, I know that voice. So I went over to this corner, and it was this little cockney. He says, "Way up, Nick," he says. He says, "There's some Germans down there, you know." And then he said, "You're now Sergeant Major Beatty." I said, "Yes." He said, "When you and Scotty left," he said, "I was right to him," I said, "you've lost two of your best soldiers." I said, "And what did he say?" He says, "He said two buggers had stopped any longer. He said they would have driven me mad." Well, we must have driven him mad, because after the war, I heard he shot himself. And you know, that little company, we were at crossroads again, and the Durhams were in front. The shell came over. First of all, there were slip trenches. There were two slip trenches. So I took one, and I put one of the lads in front, same size as me. And then there was other two lads. We dug down a slip trench under the tree. A shell came over. I heard him in front cry out. So I got up and went over to him. And damn it all, same thing had happened to him as happened to me in Scotland. Look all through it. I'm not a very affectionate fellow, eh? And he was more or less crying. He said, "Is there any blood?" I said, "Is there hell?" I said, "Same thing's happened to you as happened to me in Scotland," you see. So then I went to see what the other two were like. And they were dead. The shell sprinted down onto them. And all we did was fill them in, and that was it. And the officer came and he said, "Did you take the dog tags off?" And I said, "Oh, no. No." He made just a note in his book, like they would be dug up later and buried somewhere. And then a wounded Durham came staggering back, and one of our lads took him to the first aid post. He come back and he said, "That first aid post," he said, "it's just like a butcher's and slaughterhouse," he said, "men laid there." And he says, "You know that little cockney?" He says, "He's laid there as well." And he says, "He's cracking jokes left and right," laid there wounded. Yeah.
So the usual procedure if a man got killed then was to remove his dog tag.
Yeah.
And how did you mark his grave when you...
You'd then stick his rifle buried into the ground and his helmet on top.
And
Germans did that as well. I saw them with the helmet on top.
And at some point they would be re-dug up and...
Yes, the pioneers would come along and dig them up and take them up to the cemetery.
How was fatigue and tiredness affecting you in this heavy fighting?
Yeah, I think it didn't affect me at all. No, it was quite...
You were able to cope quite well.
Yes, we got our rest now and again for all this. There was a time we were pulled out and Horlicks, a big corps commander.
Horrocks.
He came and he was talking to us. And he'd just recovered from wounds in the desert. He took over 30 corps. He said, "I'm sorry you've had a lot of casualties." He said, he gave us a rundown of where every division was, because I was anxious to know where the 49th was, because my brother was in that one, in the Durhams. And then he said, he gave us this lowdown that there were some heavy ground, high ground they had to take. And he said, "Will you take it, even if we'll put the brigade artillery on it? And if that doesn't shift them, we'll put the divisional artillery on it. And if that doesn't shift them, we'll put the corps artillery." Well, I mean, he was a soldier, he knew what he was doing. Anyway, word came through, they'd taken it night time. But then he said, "I know you're out for a rest, 4 day rest. But he said, if the opportunity comes, that we can take an opportunity such as go back in," he says, "you'll have to go back in straight away. The opportunity arises to make an advance, you see." He said, "you'll be go straight back in." But we didn't.
Did he impress you?
He did impress me, yes, he did impress me. Especially when I saw him on TV and he talked all that way through. I was very impressive with him.
Do you remember the names of any of the French places or areas that you were in the times that you're describing to me?
No.
You're just part of the fight through Normandy?
Yes, just through. I know we went over the Orne, the River Orne, and blown the bridge. But it was down, but you could cross it. And this was a town, the other, what we went through, and the French lined up. And there was one woman with a baby, and she could talk English. And she came, as I came up to her, she said, "Kiss my baby." And I had to kiss the baby. Like, I often thought, why the hell didn't I kiss the woman at all? Well, we moved on from there, and then came the breakthrough.
Did you get a genuine rest when you were at rest?
Oh, yes.
You weren't called out to do other things?
No.
And officers didn't pester you for duties? And
No, it was proper rest, more or less, yes. Just clean your weapons, and that was more or less, be ready again.
We talked about the drafts briefly. Were they still coming from infantry depots, or were these, was the manpower shortage beginning to show?
And you
were getting men from Royal Air Force or regiments and artillery and what have you?
Well, I should think so. I mean, these two have been in England, this Sergeant Corporal. I suppose they were at one of these training battalions, depots maybe. I think most likely Sergeant Mary Beatty had done his orders like to, that's why he shot his son, more or less. I just surmise or something. It might not be true, but they were calling up them, and they started to disband some regiments and build the others up later on.
Were you beginning to respect the German as a fighting soldier?
Well, no, I just had no respect for them. I just wanted to be out of it, that's all.
You've been meeting quite a number of Panzer and SS Panzer people who were, first line troops, as we've mentioned before.
Oh, yes. I think the Northumberland Fusiliers met the Panzer lot there.
Prisoners of war, you were taking prisoners, were they taking prisoners? There wasn't any being shot, any massacres of any kind that you're coming across?
No, there was none of that.
Were they treating the civilians okay as they withdrew?
Well, they seemed to be, right, because they could have, as I say, on day one, when they took Bayou, they could have set fire to that and, could have left them all alone. It was never fired on or anything. They just withdrew, same as they did with Paris and Brussels.
Those French civilians you were meeting, were they all friendly towards the British?
Well, I would say them in Normandy weren't too pleased, because they had a good life. As you got further up, especially in Belgium, where the food situation was bad and they were treated not so good, they were pleased to see you.
Have you any other memories of the fighting in Normandy prior to the breakthrough?
Well, there's one about the Follies. I was told by one of the lads this night that Loftus came up in his jeep to come from company headquarters, and he met Hollis, and they were under this tree talking, and up in the tree was a dead sniper. Now Hollis quietly, there was a lot of telephone wire laid about, Hollis quietly looped his telephone wire round this ear. Dead sniper's ankle, and he tied it to the jeep, and as Loftus moved away, Hollis walked beside him talking all the time, and all of a sudden there's a bang, you see, and down comes dead German sniper. And Loftus looked back and he said, "You're a devil." Hollis, sergeant major, said, "You're a devil." I think Hollis went through his pockets.
Had his VC award come through by this time?
We were actually in, when it came through and announced on the TV, we were in a rest camp. You know, and we were just having our grub, and the quartermaster said to them, Stans will be on the radio about his VC coming through. And he said, Stan must have been knocking a woman about in Bournemouth or somewhere, because I heard him say, "Now it will come out that he's married." Yeah, sure. He's been a bit of a ladder, Stan.
And he must have been greatly respected by the battalion.
Oh, he was, yeah. Oh, he was, you know, he looked after his family. Yes. He sent a lot of his lads as a guard to what they call it, Field Marshal, you know, a charge up. What was his name now?
Montgomery?
Montgomery. Aye, a bodyguard. He picked them that had been longest in battle and they went as a bodyguard to him. Because they used to come back, and when they come back, we knew we were going forward like. Because Montgomery always came back with his caravan behind the division that was going to attack, and these lads would come up and talk to us, and we knew then straight away we were in for it.
You mentioned earlier that Hastings came forward quite often.
Yeah. Oh yes, yes. Hastings, you know.
You saw a lot of him.
Saw quite a bit of Hastings. Yes.
And when he came forward, what would he be doing necessarily?
Well,
talk to you?
He'd be directing the officers where to go and, you know, position to take.
Did you see any other higher ranking officers? Brigadier, for example, did you see much of him?
No. No.
Do you remember his name, who was commanding 69 Brigade?
No, we never saw him.
But you didn't see much of anything of him?
No.
Did Montgomery ever come and give you a pep talk? Or?
No.
He seemed to like to do?
Oh, he came to decorate. Hollis, that's all, in the, you know, they have a photo of him in the decorating Hollis.
He didn't come along and give cigarettes out, which was one of his things.
No.